If everyone could please take a seat, we're going to try to get started. We have a lot of perspectives that are included in this conversation, and we'd like to have time to both have each of our speakers talk a little bit about their relationship to digital education, but also have time for questions and answers. So if you could take your seat and close the door, that would be very helpful. Thank you. This is the digital education workshop focused on exception to and limitations on copyright for digital education. We have a, we'd first like to thank the co-sponsors who made this possible, and they include the Hewlett Foundation, Intel Corporation, FGV, CTS, the Ministry of Education in Chile, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the American Society of Plant Biologists, and the Yale Information Society Project, IP Justice as well. And we are actually have been discussing throughout the week digital education and the various levels and the various factors that bring our policies and norms and technologies to advance the explosion of possibilities that have taken place as a result of digital technologies in education. And so it impacts from educators on the ground in the community, teaching students in novel ways and with new technologies, all the way through the publishers and government policy to both nationally and internationally. So we're going to proceed one by one through our speakers, and I'll introduce them individually, and all of their names should soon be up on the screen as soon as that gets figured out. But to introduce first, Titi Akinsami, who is with the Global Teenager Project, and will tell us a little bit about the work of the Global Teenager Project and how they use new materials to teach people in rural and remote areas in Africa.
Thank you, Eden. Is the other microphone working? Hello? I stretched myself too far. Okay, as he said, I'm Titi Akinsami. I work for the International Institute for Communications and Development, which is based in the Netherlands, but I work out of the South Africa office. One of the advantages of being able to work online for me. I manage a project called the Global Teenager Project. It's been around since 1998. We will be 10 next year. That's a lot for us as a funded project, so to say. And what we do is very simple. So simple sometimes, I ask myself, are we really making any sense? But by the time we go through the evaluation, speak to the teachers and the learners on the ground, you realize you're actually making a difference in their lives. The GTP has two major areas of activities. We have international learning circles, and then we have something we call understanding diversity. All activities are built on one principle, that learners are not just learners, but they're people who are capable of thinking, who have the capacity to generate knowledge. What they need is someone who can help them facilitate and bring that knowledge together. So what we do on a yearly basis, at least twice a year, is have the teachers sit with the learners and decide, what would you like to learn? How would you like to learn it? And then we create the environment online where they can have this learning process with other learners from across the world. We're currently in about 30 countries in Latin America, in North America, Europe, Africa, and one or two countries in Asia. And what we do is, once they've decided, for example, we might be a maths class, a mathematics class, but what we would like to learn about is HIV/AIDS. The first question that comes to mind is, how do you as a mathematics teacher teach HIV/AIDS but still achieve your curriculum goals and use the right materials? We create an environment where that can happen. If you want to know more about the project, you'll have to see me much later. But one of the things we have encountered over the years that we've been around is the fact that we create a lot of great content. A lot of great information is created. A lot of information is appropriated. And we break a lot of copyright rules. A lot of them. I'm sure if there was to be some copyright police somewhere here, we would immediately be taken in. We do. Our teachers do. Our learners do. But learning actually happens. So what do we do? Do we punish them for making, do we punish ourselves for making learning happen? Or do we actually look at the rules? I believe in this saying that man was not made for the law was made for man. So do we need to reapproach the way we look at things, particularly in the information age? where you cannot control, and we need to agree that we cannot control, we can only make sure everybody is equipped enough to be able to make the right decisions at any point in time. I think I'll stop there for now. Thank you.
That's great. Thank you for that. For that introduction. And the purpose of this conversation and the different perspectives we have is to relate people who are working with students directly and all the way to making laws and policies across Europe, for example. Our second speaker, Maria Baggia, is a member of European Parliament and is on the delegation, the Committee of Culture and Education. If you could tell us a little bit about the development basis and the significance of education for development and freedom.
Okay, thank you very much. Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here and to be the possibility to talk a little bit about the work in European Parliament. As I said, I am a member of the Culture Committee. Culture Committee works on culture, on education, on media, on sports and youth. And especially information society is not work which is expressed into the culture committee, but in the committee of industry. Nevertheless, culture and education committee, when there is a report that is about information society, then usually we do our special report, our special apportations on the industry committee. It's a little bit complicated, but it's like that. And in this case, last year, when there was a report on information society on industry committee, my commission, culture committee, we write a report on opinion on this other committee and on this other report. That means that all our work in information society is complementing the point of view of industry in order to give our opinions on education and on culture specifically. Then my work in this report, it has been to put in it the idea that information society is not something about capability, is not something about to form people, to be competitive. It's also to educate people, not just for knowing a lot, but for being full citizens and to work with full citizenship. This is more or less my work there.
Thank you very much. Moving towards some of the issues that come up in terms of the law and relationships between the publication of content and the use of it is the issue of licensing. And next we'll hear from Ariel Verselli, who's the leader of Creative Commons Argentina, and will talk to us about CC Learned. He's also the president of ONG Bienes Comunes.
Thank you. Thank you for this invitation. I'm the leader of CC in Argentina. I'm representing in this event of CC Education, CC Learn, a project of the Creative Commons that look for solutions and look for the interoperability of different licenses for education. I'm a researcher of the National Agency of Science and Technology in Argentina, and I'm trying to look for solutions between the design of technology and the production of regulations. The solution of the Creative Commons license is a solution that look for a balance, a situation between the reservation of all research, all rights reserved, and the no right reserve of the public domain. So the narrative that defined the Creative Commons system is some rights reserve that give the opportunity to the creators, to the authors, to reserve strategically and release some rights about the work, about their works. The project of CC Learn was founded this year, a few months ago, in Dubrovnik. And in this moment, are working in the solutions of the interoperability in the OER, in the open educational resources, in any of these open educational resources, and look for different solutions in the legal and technical issues. Thank you.
Thanks. And in terms of the new licensing opportunities, we also have systems developing, and open educational resources were mentioned in particular, and we'll explore the range of materials that are being produced. But to tell us a little bit more about open educational resources, Philip Schmidt with the University of Western Cape in Cape Town, who's working on the Open Courseware Project and has a background in computer science and now open education issues.
Thanks. Is this working? Yeah. Yeah, I've been working on open education issues for a while now, and sitting on this panel here and seeing how little space we have, it seems like the community has grown tremendously, and there is almost no room to grow any bigger. I am based at the University of the Western Cape, which is a previously disadvantaged South African university, which means we don't have a lot of money. We also graduate the largest number of non-white students in South Africa. We have about 15,000 students. And when I say non-white, that includes Indian students and what the South African law calls colored students, which is not a term for black students. It's a different, distinct group. We have a rich struggle history. So UWC has always been engaging in kind of questioning the existing systems and maybe thinking towards the future. And it brought back a lot of the ANC leaders as academics when the country was preparing for its first election. And maybe because of the history of the institution and the combination of this rich history and the big challenges we're facing, we've been very interested in open education. And we do a number of things. We publish courses. So we have a few areas of expertise where we feel it's important that other people in our region, our community, have access to the materials. And we publish them kind of basically as a way to share the knowledge, but also to showcase it. So there is definitely a marketing aspect there. We use other people's materials in teaching and learning, and we are experimenting with a range of different technologies and ways of doing that, including podcasting and blogging and asking students to evaluate each other's work in much in the same way that people read other people's blogs and they comment and they kind of have discussions that go off into different areas. And finally, we have to work more and more on intellectual property issues, which isn't something we wanted to do from the beginning. And I think that's also why it's very important to have this group here, where many people are experts on the legal issues. And I have a range of questions that my colleagues gave me, but I think I'll try to come back to them later.
Okay. Yes, and we'll include questions from the audience in addition to the discussion among the participants. Next is that we'll be hearing from is Crispin Taylor, who's the executive director of the American Society of Plant Biologists, and as a publisher and also as an association of scholars, there's nuance in the various kinds of education we're talking about, and also different ways in which materials are published, and APSB has experimented with those, and you could tell us a little bit about that.
Thank you very much. It's really a great pleasure to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity to come and represent, I guess, the publishing industry in this conversation. As I get older, I learn that we all display and exhibit biases of one kind or another, and one that I'm not very proud about is that this is the first time I've been in the Southern Hemisphere for over 30 years. So I hope that doesn't happen again. But the point is that regardless of the tangent from which we're approaching a question or a problem, we need to try and leave our biases behind and just focus in on what it is that we're trying to achieve together. So I think ASPB is a relatively typical scholarly publisher in the States. We have about 5,000 members. Most of them are academics. So we're talking the same communities here, that education is what they do in addition to research. The research they do is published in our journals, which are our financial bread and butter. But the mission of the organization very much includes education and public outreach and information about, in our case, plant biology. And I think we're very typical of other professional societies in that regard, that education, writ large, is a big part of what we intend to do. Like most any other organization, we don't exist in a vacuum, and we have many opportunities for collaborating with other professional societies in science, and also publishing industry organizations. And one in particular that's based in the UK is called the Association of Learned and Professional Society Publishers, which is a group mostly of the scholarly society publishers. It's not dominated by big commercial publishers. What ASPB does is, in terms of education, and speaking strictly for the journal content, we have a very liberal copyright exception, which allows just about any educational use of our material as long as it's not for profit. And I think we could perhaps discuss later how easy it is to define that. So the journal content is widely available. To fill our other mission of educational outreach, we create a bunch of content that has nothing to do with the journals, but is targeted directly to what we call in the States K-12 education, as well as public education. So that content, whether or not it's copyright, it's made freely available, and indeed we'll send it to you in the mail if you ask us, because it fits our mission. Again, there are groups of organizations, professional societies that come together one way or another, and in terms of the scientific realm, 2009 has been declared the year of science, with a mission of a number of professional societies to educate the public about the importance of science in their lives. So in terms of a potential impact or an opportunity for engaging each other, that sort of timeline seems to work to me. Beyond what ASPB is doing in and of itself, and we already heard about some licensing arrangements, within the existing status quo of how information is moved around and how scholarly publishing operates, clearly one approach is the licensing approach. But I'm learning of other technological approaches towards embedding rights and permissions information in content in a manner that's machine readable and can be read by search engines, for example, and content for which any given user has a right to use can be discovered by these search engines. There's one that it will be formally launched at the end of the month. It's called the Automated Content Access Protocol. I have no idea whether or not it's a good one or a bad one, or even if the concept is right. But it seems to me that in addition to licensing solutions which deal with the status quo, we could also be thinking of technology solutions which may get us some point into the future. So thank you very much, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. Moving towards international regulation, Heidi Leung is our next speaker, who's in the copyright division at the World Intellectual Property Organization. Thinking about these issues, we've heard go through from the local to the publisher to the licensing arrangements, and there is activity going on in discussion and thought into how best to work on copyright issues in the international realm. If you can tell us about that.
Yes, thank you. One of our main activities in WIPO is the administration of international treaties in the area of IP, including copyright and related rights. And we, with no exception, the six treaties in the area of copyright and related rights take into account a balance between one public interest, which is the protection of authors, the protection of creations, dissemination, production of valuable works. And on the other hand, other public interests, like the right to education, the right to have access to information, freedom of speech, etc. One of our recent, not so recent, because they were adopted in 1996 and entered into force in 2002, were the treaties on copyright and related rights in the digital environment, the so-called WIPO Internet treaties. And these treaties brought a general update to facilitate the use of works in digital networks. That's why, I mean, we refer to a new, let's say, rule, general rule, for the applications of exceptions and limitations in areas like education that follow certain conditions. What are the prospects? For those that are familiar with the process in WIPO, the norm-setting activities in WIPO, currently we see a slowing down in the norm-setting activities, in the development of new norms, new treaties of copyright, and perhaps, I mean, in IP in general, and a focus on civil society issues, development issues. One of the most promising ones is the adoption of the agenda of the related to development agenda, development-related IP issues. And the idea is that member states will review, will find a way how to deal with the new social, legal, technological developments. We find also that at national level, perhaps, I mean, there are examples that are worth considering, like the principles regarding the use of out-of-print works or digitization of material, the use of orphan works as well. I think that these are key issues that perhaps, I mean, will be taken to the agenda of the SECR, our main body, the main incubator of guidelines in the area of copyright-related rights. Thank you.
Thanks very much. And now Luis Virauel Villalón, who is the copyright legal advisor to the Ministry of Education in Chile, who's also been working on exceptions to and limitations on copyright. And if you could tell us about your notion of how international norms relate to education on the ground.
Well, thank you, Adam. Anna has told me that I have no more than 3 minutes. So before he shuts down my microphone, I want to leave the message most important I want you to keep as a participant on IGF is that to implement information society principles and objectives with relation to education, we need mandatory minimum exceptions to copyright. And in those few minutes, I will try to explain you why this is very important, even that you're not related to copyright as you might think. Well, what is the current situation with exceptions and limitations internationally? If you review the laws of many countries, you have to come to the conclusion that the exceptions and limitations are very different depending on the country. And in many cases, you have a lack or absence, total absence of exceptions for educational purposes. Or even when there is such an exception, they have a different scope. So then they are not interoperable. So. And that causes a lot of problems, as I will tell you right now. But the question is why we don't have enough exceptions. I mean, we know there have been a lot of effort to harmonize copyright, and WIPO has, you know, worked in several treaties, and we see it in the current situation. We don't see the exceptions. And there are two main areas where we can work. And we have non-legal and some legal ones. And the legal one now today for government officials to implement copyright exceptions, especially for education and any other type of exception, is that traditionally to talk about exceptions limitation in government was kind of a taboo thing. You will never get, you know, training on how to implement them. So in first place, you don't have people prepared. And secondly, because we have to admit there is, you know, infringement of copyright, people felt that they don't need it. So, but now that we are entering a new stage of enforcement of copyright, definitely, as the first speaker mentioned, you will have that now teacher will equal to pirate. So definitely we are, you know, facing a very big problem, and we should address it. And the legal question, and I will be really brief on this because this can get very technical, is that it's a legal uncertainty on what is the legal standard, international legal standard, for exceptions and limitations for educational purposes. In very short, there is one standard that is called the three-step test, which is it comes from Bern Convention, then adopted by TRIPS, and then taken again by the WIPO treaties that the KD just mentioned. And there is an assumption for some scholars that that should be the standard for the exceptions for education. But on the other hand, we have that another line of thought that the exceptional limitations to education shall be ruled by the specific norm of the Berne Convention. So we could spend hours talking on why one position is right or not, but I just want to emphasize that we have that second type of problem. And so, but what is the effect of having this, you know, uncertainty and lack of exceptions? You have to imagine that, let's think on a website for educational material. The case of Chile has a website, the Ministry of Education has a website to upload content for educators. And there are other countries that have the same. Let's think of the US. And even in Latin America, there is currently a net of website of educators. But because of exceptions and limitations change so much from country to country, a work that is made legally in the US and is uploaded legally in the US, it might not be legal in Chile. An example, not even thinking on education, just a work. You make a parody of a song. It's a famous case on Pretty Woman. Somebody make a parody of the song Pretty Woman of Roy Orbison, and they just change, you know, the lyrics, they make a new and funny song. Well, that song was totally legal in the US. But because of the limitation, it's valid only in the US, because that is the law, I mean, the law of the country where you claim protection is the one that is applicable, then that song, if you take it in Chile, you know, is illegal, because if there is no parody exception in Chile. So first, you have, you know, content that is legal that you cannot use in other countries. And also, with regard to education, what is allowed, what is the exception allowed for education, change. In some cases, you might do reproduction. In other cases, you only can do communication to the public. So that is really complicated. I see Eden is standing up, so I have to. Okay, I'm just about to finish.
Well, we'll get to some of these issues in the questions and answers, because we really have the scope of issues that have discussed. And
okay, then I say goodbye.
Sorry. No, I'm sorry about that, but I appreciate everyone's discipline and trying to get the dialogue across the different interests. And we have, before we begin to broach some of the particular issues, Gwen Hinds, who is the Electronic Frontier Foundation's Director of International Affairs, will tell us a little bit about to complicate the issue even further. Well, it's already introduced by Crispin, the extent to which there's automation and technological measures which actually affect the distribution of materials.
Oh, I'm just going to go from here. In the interest of only speaking for 3 minutes before I get an axe, I'm going to give up on the PowerPoint. I want to talk about digital locks. So is that better? Yes, okay. In the interest of speaking for 3 minutes, I'm not going to do a PowerPoint, so bear with me. I'm going to talk about digital locks, what in international law is called technological protection measures. The reason we have to consider these is two treaties that Heidi mentioned from 1996 require signatories to the WIPO Copyright Treaty and the Performances and Phonograms Treaty to provide adequate legal protection and effective legal remedies against the circumvention of technological protection measures that are used by copyright owners or publishers on their copyrighted works. And the reason we have to discuss these is if you have TPMs, or technological protection measures, such as things like content scramble system on a DVD motion picture, that's one example, or you could think about an e-book, an electronic book. Adobe makes a particular format for reading text material. Many people here will be familiar with the PDF. There are other forms of proprietary e-book readers. That's the type of thing we're talking about here, an electronic lock on digital content. If you have those being used by publishers or by copyright owners, and they are backed by overbroad TPM laws implementing those two WIPO treaties, then you face three potential problems. First of all, any existing exceptions and limitations you have in your national copyright law to facilitate digital education, they can be completely overridden. And depending, again, on how broad the national implementation of these TPM laws are, you could preclude your ability to exercise, to introduce new exceptions and limitations that could foster digital education. In the United States, we've also seen that the overbroad TPM laws that are in existence there have precluded access to material that's in the public domain, and which would otherwise be freely available for use by educators. And the third thing that we need to be concerned about here, if we have overbroad TPM laws, is an issue about innovation. To have the potential to deliver on the promises that we've all heard about, digital education requires information and communication technologies and digitization technologies that are innovative, that can provide access to the world's citizens to all the great content, the collective knowledge of mankind that is currently being digitized. The problem here is that an overbroad set of TPM laws can actually stifle technological innovation. It can actually reduce access to the very information and communication technologies that we would like to see flourish in order to facilitate the promise of digital education. So this is a particular set of issues that countries around the world are currently dealing with, and the particular challenge that is facing countries who are looking to implement their existing obligations under these two 1996 treaties is this. You have legal obligations that you are required to implement to provide effective legal protection, provide adequate legal protection and effective legal remedies against circumvention of these technological measures. You want to do it in a way that actually provides room for effective copyright exceptions and limitations to facilitate digital education, and that also provides an environment that is conducive to technological innovation. How you do that is the policy challenge facing the countries around the world today. The United States, and I would say also the European Union, have had some experience in this and have had particularly broad implementations of those laws. There are no particular exceptions in United States law for education for circumvention of these technological locks. For educational purposes, those of that we've had bad and negative consequences already experienced in the United States for digital educators who, for instance, wanted to use clips of motion pictures on DVDs in their film studies classes. They've had to petition the government for a specific exception, and that exception lasts 3 years, and it, in practical terms, it's effectively useless because they only get the ability to break the lock itself, but they don't get access to the tools they need to actually do that. However, all is not lost. There are other countries who are looking at innovative ways of implementing these legal obligations. Australia and New Zealand have both looked at ways of creating different flexible regulation formulations. So they, for instance, in the proposed New Zealand law that's currently pending, educational institutions would be given permission to circumvent technological protection measures in order to provide materials to their students for educational purposes. So there are a range of different policy options that countries can consider to actually facilitate digital education while meeting these treaty obligations. But the challenge is trying to broaden the policy debate around that in ways that allow for full public representation of views, both rights holders and the interests of digital educators and self-learners and students around the world. Thank you very much.
Thanks, everyone. And I wanted to return to some of the issues that were raised. We started off to remind everyone, given the number of issues and perspectives, we started off by talking about the teachers and their relationship to copyright. And I wanted to ask Titi and follow up with Titi on the extent to which there is consideration and discussion of when to use a particular material. You said that people probably violate copyright all the time was how you related it. The question is whether or not it's a matter of discussion, whether it's part of what people talk about in terms of priorities of use of some materials over others. If you could tell us a little bit about that.
Well, in a practical sense, it's kind of difficult. I prefer to stand, sitting on the table with Lego people and understanding where they're coming from. But for the teacher, at the end of the day, is what is the best way I can achieve my curriculum goals? Because on the one hand, you have to achieve those curriculum goals. You have to meet those targets. But on the other hand, the materials you need to use those to achieve those goals are not accessible. I like the example you just gave about the clips for movies for specific educational purposes. And there you are, as a teacher, you need this information, but you cannot access it. Where you have been given the right, rightly, that you can actually make use of it, you do not have the capability to access the tools. So on an ongoing basis, it's an issue of being able to find the back door in. And consistently, the back door is being used successfully. So if the back door is being used successfully, I would say then that definitely the treaties need to be revisited. It's been revisited in the United States, but I can say in another, working in both the developed world and the developing world, you have classes from the Netherlands, for example, who are so successful and have great laws in being able to make use of that. But then I have classes from a South Africa and from a Nigeria where you do certain things like that, then immediately you cannot, the teachers do not have the right or the capability to take things like that into their own hands, so to say. I don't know if I...
Yeah, please, and Phil wanted to respond.
Yeah. Not respond, but I just want to add something to this. We've Gwen talked about kind of intentional mechanisms to lock certain, prevent certain users and lock certain people out. But I was in a session about open standards earlier today and also yesterday, and the things you described here actually remind me very much of the things that were described there. And I think standards are also a form of protection and law and choosing certain file formats. So in South Africa, coming back to the original question, a lot of the people I work with don't care about copyright. They do care about their inability to copy and paste from documents, though. So if someone sends them a document they can't get the information out of and put it into another document and print it, that really upsets them, and they'll investigate how they can change that. If it's protected by copyright or not, for many people, is not really a concern.
I wanted at this point to actually ask Heidi to talk about the extent to which you've mentioned some of the issues that WIPO is taking up now in regards to addressing the problems of education, but I also know that there's technical assistance programs and how copyright law is implemented in individual countries. There's a perception in some of the comments just made that copyright is very far away, and I'm wondering if you could comment on the extent to which WIPO attempts to bring it closer and make it relevant on a national and regional basis.
Apart from the administration of IP treaties, we also have very important activities, a very, very important program in the area of cooperation for development, for the modernization of IP systems. Perhaps, I mean, related to what Gwen said about the digital lockup, We take very seriously these issues, especially, I mean, regarding digital education. We need to take very seriously the issue of digital lockup. But it's, instead of, well, or this doesn't prevent us from thinking a little bit about, well, if there is a rational way, if there is an objective way to balance, to reconcile those interests I was referring at the beginning of the presentation, the interests of the authors and the interests of the end users. We know that the technology that is blamed to be the cause of this digital lockup is neutral. So far, right owners, owner of rights, I mean, being authors or other right holders, rely on that to keep the exclusivity, to preserve the exclusivity of the exercise of their rights. And then the idea is, well, just to work on that, on finding solutions to establish solid systems that preserve all this public interest. On the other hand, I mean, talking about the issue of mandatory exceptions that Luis mentioned, well, he says, well, I don't see the exceptions, I see them. We know that international treaties preserve and provide the possibility to member states, to nations, to establish in national laws exceptions regarding educational issues. That's why, for instance, in the United States, you find that there is a very well or very detailed system in the area of use of digital means, which is materialized in the Technology Education Copyright Harmonization Act of 2002. But then, I mean, that's why also this is why you find a very modest provision in the area of education in the copyright law of Brazil of 1998. So there is a possibility, there is an option for countries to develop norms in this area. And of course, there is also a possibility, because this is the example that we find not only in the United States, but also in the European Union, to balance, I mean, provide sufficient guarantees for the exercise of limitations and exceptions for certain beneficiaries in the European Union through the copyright directive. We find that in Article 6.4, there is a mandate to member states to preserve these exceptions and limitations while also safeguarding or giving adequate protection for this technological measure of protection used by copyright owners.
I wanted to ask first Maria Badia, if you could please comment on the extent to which commercial interests, you're talking about the importance of education, but also this balance that's trying to be struck. If you could also comment on that.
Yeah. This copyright issue has been one of the biggest discussion in the European Union and in every one of the countries of the European Union. And finally, with all the clauses, the special clauses for each little thing, what we have arrived to an agreement is that what you use from internet that is for your proper use and you are not going to use this to make money, that's free. You are absolutely free to use this material. It's a film, it's a novel, it's etc. What do you use something of this material to make money, to sell, then this is penalized. This is in general, this is what where we have arrived. It has been very difficult, and there are some, as you know, with the laws of European Union, when we approve a directive, we call this a directive, then each member state has a period of time to adapt this European law to national law. There are many countries which until now they have problems and they don't have a real law and they don't have applied this directive because it creates a lot of troubles.
I wanted to return to something that Crispin raised earlier about how to distinguish between materials that are what is commercial and what is non-commercial, and if you could raising from that, there's a perspective of there being clarity as to that, and I think you've raised already that sometimes it's difficult to determine.
So I may answer that question by sort of ducking it first. Just as Titi was saying that when you're on the front lines as an educator, you just need to get the content and use it in your classroom. With the sort of 20 staff that are existing in ASPB, the capacity to actually go out there and police and prosecute copyright violations is basically non-existent. And in the context of education, we wouldn't do it anyways because that's part of what the material is there for. But there's sort of a reciprocal inability to really worry a lot about uses of our material that may violate copyright. Now, if somebody's going to be doing something and making a lot of money from a course pack that they're selling or something like that, that's a different issue if we hear about it. But we don't have the capacity to go out there and look for that kind of thing. So when you get to the issue of whether it's a commercial use or not, the same metric sort of applies. If we are made aware of an instance that may or may not be a violation, we'll have to have a look at it and determine whether or not we can really proceed, whether we want to, if it is a violation, we think, or whether we can't or don't want to. So there's no easy answer to that one. You can get into lots of minutiae if it's an educational use at a commercial, you know, at a for-profit university or something. If it's an educational use, not in and of itself for profit, but at a university or an educational institution that is a for-profit entity, you know, I think that's splitting hairs. And I think, again, going back to the mission of the society, this stuff should be used for education, And if the university as a large entity is making money in a given year, you know, there's not much we can do about that.
I wanted to get to Ariel to speak about the extent to which there are openly licensed content that CC Learn is and the licenses that are available make possible. But in the educational context, there are many different materials and resources that are used. And I'm wondering if you can comment on the intersection between materials that are used that are copyrighted and have other kinds of licenses attached, and how they intersect with, and what the thinking is behind how they intersect with the Creative Commons licensed works as they're used in education.
Thank you. The position of CC Learn is look for a solution that improve the whole context. There are many licenses, and license with different conditions. The license of the Creative Commons in the case of CC Learn is the license of attribution. With a license with attribution, you have the choice, the possibility to remix, share, remix, and different uses, including the uses, commercial uses. But the point is different from the public codifications, for example, in the case of the treaties. In the case of Creative Commons, the solution is a little different. The solution is using the public space, but with the exercise of private law. The private law, the private rights of the people is used to produce common goods, to produce public goods, to produce, for example, the OERs, the open educational resources that we have in common, that, for example, different learners have in common. So in this position, the uses of the work and the license when we can release some materials are very important. The solution of CC Learn is trying to solve the problem of interoperability between different solutions. For example, in the case of Argentina, we have public domain with taxes. So the public domain solution is not a solution for whole the countries around the world to, for example, release or use and reuse materials for education. In that sense, for example, the license of CC Learn is better than the solution of public domain. The other point in this context is how we can create better solutions, technical and legal, to improve the system. So this is the position of CC Learn.
And in terms of legal solutions, Luis also suggested this metaphor of interoperability in terms of different countries and the different laws that they have. I was wondering, are you suggesting when you stated that there's mandatory minimum for acceptance limitations, the extent to which there are differences in individual countries and their needs for the implementation of these laws and how that conforms to the international norms that you're suggesting?
Thank you. I'm back. When we propose minimum mandatory exceptions, we are not thinking of that should be only one size for all countries. We are just saying that should be some baseline that could be common, so this type of activities that are needed in the information society to provide education can be done. Obviously, depending on the level of development of each country, it's not the same an exceptions and limitation that needs U.S. than needs Chile. If a country has an income of $1,000 a year and compared with one with $45,000 a year, it obviously the need of exceptions and limitations and how they are drafted, if they are free, they are under remuneration, that change. So we are saying that we should agree only at least in a baseline, but you might have different a ceiling depending on how developed you are.
And the extent to which the digital automation and licensing, the ability to have materials be read by search engines, as Crispin mentioned, Gwen was highlighting the trade-offs that there are works that copyright laws, if I understood you correctly, that would allow certain uses are trumped by the technological locks. How does that affect sort of the Creative Commons license works and the extent to which there's a range of different kinds of materials and the kind of technological mechanisms that are used? What kind of opportunities are there to use the different kinds of licenses with the different packages that educational centers take on?
I think I want to just draw a quick distinction between two different types of digital locks, or digital information, I guess is the way I would put it. So the digital locks that I was talking about are covered by one part of the 1996 treaties, and then there's another part of the treaty that deals with what's called rights management information. Some information that rights holders can attach to a document, metadata, and that can be read by a search engine. I think Creative Commons has done a really good job of trying to address this issue. They've been aware right from the get-go that that technological protection measures, when applied by downstream secondary users of Creative Commons licensed works, that can preclude the entire object, the entire expression of wishes of the creator of the work. And Creative Commons, in their latest version of the licenses, have actually produced language that is directed at that, and that precludes the purports to, if you're complying with the terms of the license, it purports to preclude a technological protection measure being used to block Creative Commons licensed material. I think the issues are different for some of the OER material, because I don't think that issue has been addressed in the other types of material that are currently available for OER courses, but I think it's a useful source of conversation going forward in the future. Public domain works are again a different category again, and I think those works are particularly vulnerable to being precluded by the combination of technological protection measures backed by overbroad laws. That's already happened in the United States, and I think there's quite a high possibility that that's going to happen elsewhere, where there are overbroad legal regulatory mechanisms in place. So a partial answer and a suggestion for future conversation.
Ariel wanted to reply.
Yeah, thank you. Just a comment on the introduction of new concepts to think and rethink the problem of education in the digital area. There are specific conditions to think in the release or the production, the access of different open educational resources, for example, inside of the educational field or outside the educational field. I think that the answer is yes, because we have different conditions. When you, for example, are thinking in the technological measures outside the field of education, you are thinking about the fair use, you are thinking about the difference between the expression or the manage of these authorial rights or copyright. But in the case of education, the thing is different. You need to make a difference between the different levels in education. For example, the primary school or the secondary school, or for example, the graduate or postgraduate situation. for example, in the materials. And the other point is establish a difference between the industry content and the rights of the production of different contexts in the context of the scholar, in the schools, inside the schools, the production, the collaborative production of different materials inside the schools, between the learners with teachers. This is the second difference. So the first one is the concept of expression, different from, for example, management, the manage of different cultural rights or copyrights. And the other one is the difference between the industry content and the content that produce the learner inside the school. In my view, there are different solutions and different ideological and political positions in these positions.
I wanted to actually also open up to questions from the audience if you want to raise your hand and direct your question to any of the individual speakers or everyone collectively. You wanted to respond to that in particular?
Okay, thank you very much. Wolfgang Benedek, University of Graz in Austria. My general perception is that the copyright treaties become more and more restrictive and intellectual property rights are more and more enforced. So TRIPS agreement of the WTO has not been mentioned here, but it's more and more enforced around the world. On the other hand, I see also other possibilities. And for example, European Union, if I'm doing research which is supported by the European Union, there is usually the clause that this should be made publicly available. So the research has to be put on the web page and everybody can benefit from it. I think that this is a very good policy. When you fund research publicly, then this should also be publicly available. So my question is, if this example or this this practice is also followed in other countries, because that would already make some difference. Second, you can also do something as an author yourself. I used to negotiate with my editor when I did the book on human rights education. I said, I want to put it on the web page and it should be available worldwide, but you can also print it. And he agreed. I mean, this is something where you can do something yourself, and I think you should. And third, there is the possibility, I mean, the question which still is there, or the possibility which I see for the developmental context, is that those who manage or who sell data banks, which has many journals and so on, often they have a preferential treatment for educational institutions in the South. But you might know better. So my question is, what you know about this, and if this is also of importance in practice. Thank you.
Did you want to address that, or Maria, did you want to address that? No.
I just want to mention that limitations and exceptions in general, not regarding only education, vary from one country to another. I mean, we have general rules in international treaties, but the way nations or member states devise these exceptions and limitations, well, the sky is the limit. I mean, there are certain standards, but, well, that's why, I mean, we find that there are certain exceptions at European level that, well, don't exist, for instance, in this region, in the Latin American region. On the other hand, I mean, talking about the way an author can deal with the let's say, the ownership of the creation, well, again, the international treaties don't say anything about the transfer of rights. So, taking into account the example you just mentioned about public funded research, for instance, or papers that are the outcome of a public funded research, again, I mean, the rules of transfer vary from one country to another. So that depends on what you find in the national legislation in question.
Add to that.
Yes, I also want to add a few thoughts to this. So, first of all, I totally agree with you that there is flexibility and that we should take advantage of that. But I think just placing the things on the website is not enough taking advantage of that. And a point that I think needs to be, or from the perspective of my university, we decided to license our materials under a Creative Commons license. There are different options and different people have different preferences, but the important thing from our perspective was that the license in plain English or any other language says what other people are allowed to do with it. Whereas with copyright, even if I download your book as a lecturer in a South African university, I cannot print it 30 times for all of my students. I can direct all of them to your website to print it for themselves, though. So it's incredibly complicated. Nobody really understands all these details, whereas Creative Commons licenses give you full control over how you want to license your work. And as Titi said, when it's on the internet, you're already assuming that there is a certain level of control that you have to give up. And other people who are using the works can be very clear on how they can use them. So I think that's something to keep in mind. And the journals, I know we pay, my library pays about 10 million rand a year for journal subscriptions, including the electronic ones, which is just, well, it's 1 million euros, which probably isn't very much compared to what European universities pay, but it's a huge amount of money in our context, and the costs are going up, even with the preferential treatment.
I would like to say something, but
is it related to what was just said?
Very, very short in relation to what you said. Yes, it's true. European Union has its clause about research, but there are many other clauses because 27 countries, 27 different histories, interests. It's very difficult to arrive to a common point in an issue so difficult like this. I just would say that with the topic we are talking about, which is very technical, but on the other hand, it's very cultural. And I would say there are two words that they are involved very much with this discussion. One is balance and the other is flexibility. And I think all the time we are working in order to find the balance between protecting the creation and the creators and protecting the freedom of communication and information. And that's the difficulty to get the point.
The short answer to your question about publicly funded research, in the US there's a similar proposal dealing with NIH-funded research that is currently being discussed in Congress.
I was not going to say anything about the NIH, but if anybody's interested, I know quite a bit about that. What I was going to say is related to your question about access to content in the South. And it's unfair, I know, but there are a number of initiatives, some of them run by the UN, in science. There's a series that I can rattle off: Agora, which deals with agricultural literature; Hinare, which is health literature; and ORA, which is environmental science. A large number of publishers provide their content through those portals for free to countries below a certain cutoff in terms of the World Bank income levels. And it must be added, with the opportunity to yank specific countries from among the collection below that line. China, for example, has a lot of money that it's investing in science and technology, education and research, but on a per capita basis, income is very low in that country. So there are mechanisms that publishers willingly partake of. And in the not-for-profit community, which is where I think the best journals are published in terms of their impact factors and things like that, enthusiastically and widely participate in these initiatives.
Yes. No, I already raised this issue on another panel, just the problem is access of students to scientific information. I am coming from Russia myself, and I can tell you for sure that less than 1% of Russian students use academic databases like JSTOR, like EBSCOnet, like Social Sciences Citation Index. That just means that in Russia and the other countries of the region, most students do not simply have access to the best information. And as a result, you get not very well informed specialists in the end and not very well informed researchers. It's not, of course, only a Russian problem. I was, for example, in the library of University of Vienna. They also have quite a poor database for this. I didn't notice Egyptian students using very much this kind of databases. I didn't notice this in Tanzania. So this truly a big gap, access to scientific information. And I think that the United Nations has to do something about it, maybe to have negotiations with all these databases to give their services for lower rate in not very rich countries. Another point which I have also discussed, that there is a lot of free information in the form of the reports of the United Nations and other authoritative intergovernmental organizations. So perhaps there might be some general site which could direct students in different languages to this kind of sources. Thank you. So perhaps the question is if what is done on the level of the United Nations in this direction.
Does anyone want to answer?
Well, I just want to make a comment on the Heidi just mentioned with relation to your question that the for exceptions in many countries, the sky is the limit. Making the relation with your question, I would say trade sanctions is the limit. So it's a very complicated issue. We all agree there are flexibilities, but then again, my first question: why don't we have implemented the flexibilities? And the truth is that it's not easy to pass a law on exception. It's not like to declare a holiday. In Chile, we had experience a few years ago. We proposed a law on exceptions, and we got such a pressure for organized entities that they was stalled in Congress. So that's why it's so important that stakeholders, especially educators and people related to access, get awareness of the problem. And I think IGF is a good place to start, where the community recognize the importance, because people has not been trained on to address this issue. It's encouragement if a body like this recognize the need to provide some implementation and give some model or guidelines, because it's always the concern of a public official: am I going too far? Am I going to lose my job? Is somebody going to call the president and say that we are totally out of our head? So that's why it's so important that be aware it's an issue. There is flexibility, but there is other forces that might stop you from doing what you have to do.
Yes, I ask you, excuse me, but I have someone waiting for me 20 minutes in the other hotel. Thank you very much for this talk, and I must leave. Thank you.
Wanted to give the opportunity for some of our co-sponsors to reflect on some of what has been said in the form of comments or directed questions. Aniko Genge is from the Hungarian Ministry of Justice and Law Enforcement, and they're working on gratefully co-sponsoring this workshop and are working on educational issues.
Thank you very much. As Eden said, I work for the Ministry of Justice, which is responsible for the copyright legislation in Hungary. Hungary is a very small country in Europe where the digital education is in an embryonic phase. That's why copyright limitations and exceptions play a very important role in the motivation of the development in this field. Although I can imagine that in a more developed situation when the digital education will be a widespread method of teaching in Hungary, the exclusive rights and copyright licenses can play a more important role. I think this workshop is very important for us to see which directions are the good ones and what is the experience of the other interested parties. As a closing remark in this workshop, I would like to mention two case studies. In the Hungarian law, we have a very interesting new exception, which is based on the Article 5.3n of the Information Society Directive. I think it's transposed in a very unique way in Hungary. On the basis of this limitation, the collections of schools, libraries, archives, and museums can be connected to each other in a closed network. Practically, it means that the collection of the National Film Archive is accessible from the school in the countryside, or the collection of the National Audiovisual Archive can be seen in every museum that's connected into this system. It means that the collections are accessible in a closed circle, for example, in schools, but of course it doesn't mean that everybody could access them from home. It makes possible a relatively wide access to a lot of contents for educational aims. My only fear is that this interconnectivity of the institutions is possible only on a very wide interpretation of the directive, although it hasn't been objected by the European Commission yet. And I have to mention a research project which was funded by the European Commission and which the partners are academic institutions and archives from Netherlands, Finland and Hungary. The main aim of this project is to develop a special file sharing software and to find the opportunities how to use it in a legal way for cultural preservation, education and research. It's obvious that there are no specific limitations and exceptions which could help this system, but the lawyers of this project work on the task of shaping licensing methods which could be workable in this environment, and they plan to suggest the Commission to consider the results of this project when recasting the Article 5 of the Information Society Directive. So it was my two examples, and thank you very much for this interesting debate today, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks. Pedro Parangua from FGV CTS, if you could mention a few words.
Yeah, well, I think we, in order to move forward, we could at least follow 3 points. One would be to have an international instrument in order to provide for mandatory minimum standards, exception limitations to copyright law. While that doesn't happen, I think there's still room for changes in national levels. And that's what we from FGV Rio are trying to do here. So we have a partnership with the Brazilian Ministry of Culture and also with the largest Brazilian consumers group, IDEC, in order to make a study and to suggest an amendment to our copyright law in order to bring more flexibility to the system. And a third step would be to at least use free and open access licenses such as the Creative Commons. And can I make a question? Okay, I'd like to make a question to the representative of WIPO. It would be accepted at WIPO a proposal on minimum standards, minimum exception and limitations, mandatory minimum exceptions and limitations as an international instrument agreement?
Direct question?
Direct answer. Yeah. First of all, I mean, WIPO is an agency. I mean, you are talking about the WIPO Secretariat or WIPO, the Association of Member States, and I think that you are referring to the second. So let me tell you that already in 2004, an issue regarding limitations and exceptions for certain beneficiaries, mainly disabled persons, educational institutions, and libraries, was included in the agenda of the Standing Committee on Copyright and Related Rights. So the idea is that member states will focus discussions on these issues and, well, agree on standards that can be, well, hard law. You are talking about an international treaty, or recommendations. We don't know. I mean, it's a decision, a political decision of member states. The issue is already in the agenda. Of course, I mean, we can do some work. In the meantime, we have already the mandate to work on this issue. I'm talking now about the WIPO Secretariat. One example that illustrates this point is the a study we commissioned in the area of distance education and digital rights management systems that survey the different technologies that were available for educational uses. I think that is an important contribution in this respect. And, well, we think that member states, as I said, have postponed the work on the possible protection, additional protection on broadcasting organizations, a treaty on broadcasting organizations. And everything indicates that perhaps, I mean, there will be more time for member states to focus on these new topics.
Brad Biddle, senior attorney at Intel.
Thanks, Don. I'll just comment really briefly. First of all, I'm thrilled that we were able to be part of this, and I really congratulate the panel. It was a fascinating discussion, and thank you and congratulations to Idan and the Yale ISP team did an incredible amount of work putting this together, and it really shows. It was a fantastic discussion. Just briefly, I think Intel's interest, we've had a longstanding and deep interest in education issues, as manifest by, among many other things, we have a $300 million teacher training program underway in connection with the Clinton Global Initiative and a whole host of other things that you can see on intel.com/education. We also have a longstanding and deep interest in robust limitations and exceptions. We think that you know, fair use-like limitations and exceptions are good for education and good for innovation and creativity generally. So I'm thrilled to see the discussion and really look forward to, I hope this is just the beginning of a lot of ongoing dialogue. And again, congratulations to Idan and to the panel.
And Robin Gross of IP Justice.
Thank you. I just wanted to focus that on, because of the expansion that we're seeing in copyrights internationally, we have to see a similar...
Is this better?
We have to see a similar updating with respect to limitations and exceptions to those rights in order to maintain the traditional balance that we've had in copyright. And I wanted to focus on one place in particular where the update of limitations and exceptions is critically needed in order to facilitate the needs of education, and that's with respect to music. Specifically, music education needs exceptions and limitations to copyright to apply to audio and visual works. Copyright holders, in particular recording studios, are more likely to consider the copying of audiovisual recordings to be an infringement, while the quotation of the same amount of text would generally be accepted. So there's this distinction between the type of media. We need the ability to present audio and video in order to educate with respect to music. And I wanted to cite one example. I'm involved with the Monterey Jazz Festival's Digital Music Education Project, and this is a collection of Creative Commons licensed online interviews with influential jazz artists and their musical, and it describes their musical techniques and their musical styles and their musical influences. And then these interviews link to short video clips, usually on YouTube, of the artists demonstrating this technique. And these are generally created by unknown third parties and just posted onto YouTube. So the best way to learn about a song or a musical technique is by hearing it, not by reading about it. How do you adequately describe John Coltrane's sound on the saxophone without hearing it? So there's a need for clear international permissions to use audiovisual content in order to meet the legitimate needs of music education. And because of the transborder nature of the internet, well, that means this has to be addressed at an international level. So where can we work on this? Well, we've heard a few good suggestions today, and I think WIPO is a good place to start, particularly with respect to Chile's proposal on limitations and exceptions. Also, the development agenda program at WIPO is another place where exactly these kinds of limitations and exceptions can fit into. And I also think on the national level we can work on this issue. In particular, librarians and music teachers and other educators, just do it. And then educate the lawmakers on why this is necessary. Show them how and show them why. Thank you very much. Are you done?
So I want to thank everyone also for your patience. In particular, I wanted to thank Julia Sonnevend, Catherine McDaniel, and Nathaniel Gleischer with the Yale ISP. Who have helped bring everyone together, and we've actually been having discussions at various points throughout the week, and I'm glad that this workshop advanced that discussion forward. I appreciate everyone's patience in being brief and to the point, but I believe that we've been able to survey the issues and look in the future as to what further research and what further efforts we want to focus on. We have tomorrow a press conference of a dynamic coalition that's grown out of the conversations taking place here, and it's in the press conference room, and that's at 10 a.m. tomorrow morning. Again, thank you so much to all of our speakers for their time and for their expertise. And it's 8 o'clock. Thank you for staying till now.